headlines, Iran says France is destabilizing the Persian Gulf region after Paris signed a record 14 billion euro deal to sell Rafale fighter jets to the United Arab Emirates. Police in Sudan fire tear gas as thousands of protesters rally against the October military coup and the country's military-dominated government. And Italy and Poland will tighten restrictions on people unvaccinated against COVID-19 as Germany plans to make vaccination compulsory for some jobs. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. France is under fire for its recent arms deal with the United Arab Emirates that is part of a Saudi-led coalition waging a devastating war in Yemen. Now Iran says such weapon sales by the European nation are aimed at destabilizing the Persian Gulf region.
The militarization of our region is unacceptable. Billions of euros worth of advanced weapons, which European countries such as France sell to the Persian Gulf Arab nations, is the source of turmoil, including a devastating war on the defenseless Yemeni people. This process is irresponsible and destructive. We must not forget the destructive and destabilizing role countries such as France play in this regard.
Khatibzadeh also slammed what he called the European countries' double standards when it comes to Iran's defense program. He said they condemn Iran for its missile program, but continue delivering lethal arms to some of the regional states. Earlier this month, the UAE and France signed a 14 billion euro arms deal that will see Abu Dhabi acquiring 80 Rafale fighter jets and 12 military helicopters. Rights groups have condemned the deal and have urged Paris to stop the weapons sales. Geopolitical analyst Hania Tarkayan says conflicts in the West Asian region help arms manufacturers in Europe and the U.S. to reap huge benefits by selling their products.
It's of course there is pressure from the weapons companies because they are very active in the U.S. And also in Europe it's the same. I mean, we have the same problem. We have companies which produce weapons in Italy, in France. We have just talked about this, and so they have to sell what they produce. They have no choice, so they need wars. But as I said, on the other hand, we must remember also that there are some other ideological interests as well. So they want in the Middle East, they want to be not just wars, but also to be a state of destabilization. So people in the Middle East, they have to continue to fight each other. This is what they want also for economical reasons, but also for ideological interests.
Iran's prime minister has condemned the presence of all foreign forces deployed to Syria without coordination with the country's government.
The Islamic Republic of Iran condemns the presence of foreign forces in Syria, which is without coordination with the central government, elected by the vote of the Syrian people, and considers this military presence as harmful to regional peace and security.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a joint presser with his Syrian counterpart Faisal Miqdad in Tehran. The top Iranian diplomat also denounced Israeli strikes on Syria, stressing that the regime is the root cause of insecurity in the region. Amir Abdullahian also described mutual relations with Syria as strategic. He said that Tehran has a comprehensive plan for the reconstruction of the country. The top diplomat also called for closer trade cooperation with Syria, under what he called its new circumstances. He said that Iran is ready to export technical and engineering services to the Arab country. Faisal Miqdad has also met with the Iranian president and discussed bilateral ties. Tehran and the parties to the 2015 nuclear deal have held 7 rounds of talks this year to resolve outstanding issues. Iran offered 2 documents at the most recent discussions, which ended on Friday. But the European members, namely Germany, Britain, and France, have stated that Iran's demands are in violation of the nuclear deal's terms. The U.S. has also expressed the same. Iran, on the other hand, says it is adhering to the text of the previous rounds, but has expanded on issues like verification of sanctions removal.
This year, Tehran and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear agreement have undertaken 7 rounds of negotiations to settle unresolved concerns. The most recent round of discussions concluded on Friday in Vienna, Austria. In the discussions, Tehran has repeatedly indicated that it wants all the U.S. sanctions lifted. Sanctions placed by the U.S. on Iran when Washington unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018. Tehran has also consistently criticized the United States for its attitude to the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Tehran says that before discussing Iran's nuclear responsibilities under the accord, Washington must fulfill its promise to remove all anti-Iran sanctions. In an interview with ANSA, an Italian news agency, Iran's deputy foreign minister, Ali Borelikhani, stated that the Islamic Republic will not back down from its demand for the removal of sanctions against the Iranian nation. Borelikhani noted that Washington should take the first step because it was the party that quit the accord in 2018. Borelikhani is also the top Iranian negotiator in the talks over the removal of sanctions. He spoke about the draft documents Tehran presented during the latest round of negotiations in Vienna this week. Borelikhani said the proposals are logical and well-founded and could be a basis for further talks. At the 7th round of negotiations in Vienna, Tehran offered its plans of action to members of the P4+1 in the form of 2 suggested draft documents, one relating to the removal of oppressive and unlawful U.S. sanctions, and the other to the nuclear issue. Meanwhile, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany, all signatories to the nuclear deal, have raised concern over Iran's demands, claiming that they violate the provisions of the agreement. Iran yet denies this, saying it is adhering to the text of the previous rounds, but has expanded on issues like verification of sanctions removal.
Well, it's a problem because this is not simply a rational process. The other side, effectively, is a block of NATO countries that are involved in a series of wars in this West Asian region, and they are desperate to hang on to some new pretext. This was an important pretext for them to try and submit Iran, to try and constrain the regional influence of Iran. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the nuclear issue at all, but as you can see, they've been trying to add new matters of trying to control Iran's missile capacity and so on. So,
as an informed source acquainted with the discussions told Press TV, the Islamic Republic's suggested drafts are fully compliant with the JCPOA and its principles. In an interview with Doha-based Al Jazeera on Friday, Iran's senior negotiator Ali Borelikhani also stated that Tehran's 2 proposed drafts cannot be rejected.
Although Iran's lead negotiator Ali Borelikhani said the Islamic Republic believes in discussions and is optimistic about the potential consequences, with Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has accused Iran of nuclear blackmail on the day of the talks. Iran has condemned Israel's bid to halt the Vienna negotiations, warning the parties in Vienna not to be swayed by Israeli efforts to poison the negotiations.
In an interview with the Doha-based Al Jazeera network on Friday, Iran's top negotiator Ali Borelikhani stated that external players, particularly Zionists, are making major attempts to obstruct and disrupt the process of discussions between Iran and the P4+1 group of nations in Vienna. Right on the eve of the negotiations, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett alleged that the regime is very worried about the readiness to remove the sanctions. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman slammed the Israeli regime, saying Tel Aviv despises dialogue, since its genesis is based on war, tension, and terror. Saeed Khatibzadeh noted that the delegates in Vienna won't take instruction from the Israeli Prime Minister. Naftali Bennett has accused Tehran of carrying out, quote, nuclear blackmail as a negotiation tactic and urged concrete measures against Tehran. This followed the Israeli foreign minister's visit to the UK and France to ensure that banking sanctions against Iran will stand. Tehran has warned the parties in Vienna not to be influenced by Israeli attempts to poison the talks.
But they are always worried about being abandoned. And of course, the threats they make against Iran are utterly empty, except in the sense that they count on or they rely on the fact that were there to be a serious conflict between the Israeli colony and Iran, the US would rush to back them up. But they're very worried that might not happen.
The US administration of President Joe Biden had said it was willing to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it has retained the sanctions as leverage. Iran says it won't settle for anything less than the removal of all US sanctions in a verifiable manner. It also wants guarantees that the US would not abandon the agreement again.
Sudanese police clash with thousands of protesters holding yet another rally in the capital, Khartoum, to denounce the October coup and a new military-dominated government. The police used tear gas to disperse the crowd who had gathered near the presidential palace, carrying national flags and chanting slogans like "No to military rule." The protesters also denounced a recent deal that saw Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok reinstated after his ouster. Critics accuse Hamdok of betrayal. Pro-democracy activists are opposed to any deal with the military, citing its deadly crackdown on protests. Sudan's top general seized power and detained civilian leaders, including Hamdok. But international condemnation and mass protests forced the military to bring back a transitional government. About 45 people have been killed in crackdowns and protests over the past 2 months. Several European countries are taking extra measures to stem the surge of or in COVID-19 infections amid concerns over the new Omicron variant. Italy has tightened curbs on the people still not vaccinated, limiting their access to an array of places and services. The rise in COVID cases in recent weeks has also prompted authorities to make health pass obligatory for all public transport. In Germany, a nationwide lockdown has already started for the unvaccinated citizens. The government is also planning to make jabs compulsory in 2022. Elsewhere in Europe, Poland is set to announce a new package of pandemic restrictions this week in response to Omicron and how to handle the Christmas holidays. Polish Health Ministry reported over 13,000 new coronavirus cases on Monday. Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territories are under the spotlight again as the regime forces kill yet another Palestinian man in Al-Quds. Hashtag Trending takes a review of social media reactions to the latest Israeli killing.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Israel's atrocities against Palestinians once again go viral throughout social media following the shooting dead of a young man in the occupied territories. On Saturday evening, Israeli officers shot directly at the 25-year-old Palestinian man at point-blank range until his death. The incident occurred in the vicinity of the Damascus Gate Plaza in the occupied Al-Quds. The incident sparked outrage among Palestinians who described it as execution in cold blood. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry called on the international community to reconsider the definition of terrorism after the Israeli authorities praised this officer who killed this young man. Let's head on to our first tweet by Jay Paul. It reads, Palestine Foreign Ministry, terrorism must be redefined after Israel praises police who killed Palestinian youth. We have a couple of comments by Jim Bob. The first one reads, the guy he stabbed ran up on him from behind. Knife for self-defense of Palestinians, but U.S. arms for Israel. I wonder how many times the IDF have claimed self-defense. Also by Jim Bob, the settlers carry guns, so carrying a knife whilst under occupation is acceptable. Resistance doesn't bow to the oppressor, and this hero showed that. The Israelis claim that the man had attempted to stab officers at the site prior to the incident, but many say that this was a clear example of extrajudicial killing. They also blame the international communities for failing to put a stop to Israel's continued crimes against the Palestinians. Our next comment comes from DC. This was the excuse. He is unarmed and on the floor. This is the deliberate murder of an unarmed young man by the Zio-Nazi tyranny. They murdered many others like this, including unarmed women and children. JJ also wrote, in these illegally occupied by Israel-Palestinian territories, the Israeli soldiers shoot the Palestinians for fun. Then they throw a knife on the ground, kick it towards them, and exclaim, oh, he tried to stab me. Then they all laugh and were kept under military law by Israel. It's legalized murder every day. Siptain Ali tweeted, they, Israeli, are not human, and world will support such terrorists. It's awful when the West makes propaganda and highlights videos of saving any animals so they can call it humanity, but when it comes to Palestine, Bahrain, Yemen, etc., then I don't know where such humanity disappears. That is pure, unadulterated hypocrisy. Kafar Kush wrote, the real murderers and child killers are in the UK and the USA, pretending to be innocent. Despite all the odds, Palestinians believe resistance is the ultimate key to victory. And the case of Qaid al-Fasfus is the latest to prove it right. A Palestinian administrative detainee who won his freedom after a 131-day hunger strike in protest against his illegal imprisonment. A tweet by Quds News Network reads, Qaid Fasfus, a Palestinian prisoner who last month ended 131 days of hunger strike in protest of his administrative detention without charge or trial by Israel, hugs his mother following his release from Israeli prisons. Hashtag freedom all. The next tweet by Eye on Palestine reads, the Palestinian prisoner Hisham Abu Hawash continues his hunger strike in protest of his administrative detention without charge or trial in the Israeli occupation jails. Hashtag freedom all. And our final comment and tweet comes from Motherland. It reads, while taking part in a protest outside Israel's prison of Damon, in solidarity with Palestinian female prisoners, activists brought a cake and celebrated the birthday of one of the prisoners behind the prison bars in a very considerate gesture.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Pfizer is among the big pharma companies trying to block legislation strengthening whistleblowers' ability to report corporate fraud. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Li Fang, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Pfizer is lobbying to thwart whistleblowers from exposing corporate fraud. Stay tuned for more. Pfizer and other large pharmaceutical corporations are pushing to block legislation that would make it easier for whistleblowers to hold companies liable for corporate fraud. In the midst of a dizzying legislative environment, with much attention focused on the Build Back Better debate, major corporate interests, including Pfizer, are fighting an update to the False Claims Act, a Civil War-era law that rewards whistleblowers for filing anti-fraud lawsuits against contractors on behalf of the government. The law has historically returned $67 billion to the government, with whistleblowers successfully helping uncover wrongdoing by military contractors, banks, and pharmaceutical companies. The law has been particularly thorny for Pfizer. In 2009, Pfizer paid $2.3 billion in criminal and civil fines to settle allegations that the company illegally marketed several drugs for off-label purposes that were specifically not approved by the Food and Drugs Administration. The company instructed its marketing team to advertise Bixtra, which was approved only for arthritis and menstrual cramps for acute and surgical pain issues. The lawsuit brought under the False Claims Act through the actions of six whistleblowers ended in one of the largest healthcare fraud settlements in history. But the law poses far less risk today to companies engaged in criminal behavior. That's because the anti-fraud statute has been severely hampered by a series of federal court decisions that radically expanded the scope of what's known as materiality. In 2016, the Supreme Court ruled in Universal Health Services v. United States ex rel. Escobar that a fraud lawsuit could be dismissed if the government continued to pay the contractor. The court reasoned that if the government continues to pay a company despite fraudulent activity, then the fraud is not material to the contract. That ruling functionally neutered application of the False Claims Act against many companies that are so large that the government cannot abruptly sever payments, especially against large healthcare interest and defense contractors. Recent court decisions, including cases involving Honeywell and Halliburton, show contractors winning dismissal of fraud by simply citing continued government payments. Last year, a federal district court dismissed the False Claims Act case against engineering company AECOM, brought by a whistleblower alleging widespread billing fraud for a $2 billion contract in Afghanistan. AECOM lawyers also cited the government's continued payments to the company. The lawsuit is now under appeal. What's more, the federal government has taken an active role in discouraging cases. In 2018, the Trump administration's Justice Department issued the Grandstone Memo, which encouraged the dismissal of more whistleblower-initiated suits under the False Claims Act. In October, Attorney General Merrick Garland officially rescinded the overly restrictive memo, a move widely seen as designed to promote greater False Claims Act enforcement. The erosion of the statute has brought together a bipartisan push led by Senator Chuck Grassley to update the law to give whistleblowers greater protection against potential industry retaliation and make it more difficult for companies charged with fraud to dismiss cases on procedural grounds. Earlier this year, as he introduced the legislation, Grassley took to the Senate floor to showcase images of scrapped multi-billion Afghanistan war contracts and examples of fraud cases that have escaped accountability because of the judicial constraints placed on the False Claims Act. Thundered the senator, defendants get away with scalping the taxpayers because some government bureaucrats failed to do their job. In many years of investigating the Department of Defense, it has taught me that a Pentagon bureaucrat is rarely motivated to recognize fraud. That's because the money doesn't come out of their pocket, he added. The legislation, the False Claims Amendments Act of 2021, adjusts the materiality standard to include instances in which the government made payments despite knowledge of fraud if other reasons exist for continuing the contract. The bill also expands the anti-retaliation protections of the law, which currently only cover current whistleblower employees of a company. The bill seeks to prevent an industry from blacklisting former whistleblowers seeking employment. That push has run into a buzzsaw of corporate opposition, some of it disclosed and some of it shrouded from public view. Pfizer hired Hazen Marshall, a former policy director for Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, to lobby on the issue, along with the law firm Williams & Jensen, a powerhouse that employs an array of former congressional staffers. Pfizer, which has cast itself as a hero in the fight against COVID-19 and trustworthy corporate citizen, did not respond to a request for comment. In an initial test vote, the bill was blocked. In August, Grassley proposed his False Claims Amendment Act as an amendment to the bipartisan infrastructure agreement in the Senate. The bill, however, never reached the floor for a vote because of an objection lodged on behalf of Senate Democrats. In October, the legislation again found a hearing. Senator Tom Cotton attempted to erase most of the bill in a Judiciary Committee meeting. The amendment Cotton proposed sought to strike all substantive lines of the bill except for the first title, which is simply the description of the legislation. During committee debate, Cotton argued that the Supreme Court made the right decision in the Escobar case on the continued payment standard for materiality. The legislation potentially could increase healthcare costs, the senator argued, echoing industry claims that litigation from the False Claims Act would force healthcare interests to raise prices. The American Hospital Association reportedly lobbied to delay a vote, but the bill eventually passed 15-7 out of the Senate Judiciary Committee with the support of Grassley and his main co-sponsor, Senator Patrick Lee. This is a very concerted lobbying effort that really took our supporters on Capitol Hill by surprise, said Stephen Kahn, a whistleblower attorney with the law firm Kahn and Colapino. Many of the companies engaged in the lobbying fight have chosen to conceal their efforts through undisclosed third-party groups such as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which has made the Grassley bill one of its primary targets for defeat. The chamber does not disclose its membership for which corporations direct its advocacy, but previous reporting suggests companies such as Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, and J.P. Morgan Chase, among others, have faced False Claims Act violations in the past. Other trade groups, including the American Hospital Association, the Healthcare Leadership Council, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and the American Bankers Association, have lobbied against the bill without disclosing the companies directing their actions. The known corporate interests lobbying on the Grassley bill include Pfizer, Amgen, AstraZeneca, Merck, and Genentech. These companies listed the legislation on lobbying disclosures. All five have paid nine-figure settlements over healthcare fraud brought to light through False Claims Act. Drug companies are notorious for paying kickbacks, giving benefits in exchange for a competitive advantage. Drug companies and healthcare firms are about 80% of the False Claims Act recoveries for a reason, said Kahn. In the case of Pfizer's record settlement, whistleblowers charged that the company promoted Bextra for uses that were not approved by the FDA, placing patients at risk for heart attack and a stroke. The company allegedly paid doctors kickbacks for off-label uses. The False Claims Act, like other quitem laws, awards whistleblowers a portion of the money the government recovers from lawsuits. John Kopchinski, one of Pfizer's whistleblowers following the settlement, said, "The whole culture of Pfizer is driven by sales, And if you didn't sell drugs illegally, you were not seen as a team player. The Grassley Initiative is championed by a diverse array of watchdog groups over government waste. Taxpayers Against Fraud, the National Whistleblower Center, the Project on Government Oversight, and the Government Accountability Project are among the group officially supporting the update to the anti-fraud law. But advocates have expressed confusion over the involvement of several other supposed taxpayer protection organizations. Citizens Against Government Waste and Americans for Tax Reform, two conservative groups that do not disclose donor information, filed a letter to lawmakers urging them to vote down the Grassley measure. Despite Citizens Against Government Waste's official focus on fighting government waste, the very intent of the False Claims Act, the group's lobbying arm argued in a letter that the bill was not appropriate for inclusion in the infrastructure package because it is not related to traditional infrastructure, and the bill is not fully understood by the 95 senators who have not co-sponsored the legislation. Americans for Tax Reform similarly argued that the legislation had not received proper debate. Neither Citizens Against Government Waste nor Americans for Tax Reform responded to requests for comments explaining why they have lobbied so aggressively against taxpayer protection legislation and whether any donor interests are involved.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked and
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
بعد امام صادق مثال زد فرمود علم ینسب داوود.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, in order to clarify the harms of the tongue of the people, gives us examples and states, didn't the people call Prophet Dawood a pigeon fancier, a person who is after playing with the birds? Or didn't the people accuse Prophet Dawood for being after the wife of Uriah, the commander of the army? Didn't the people call Prophet Moses a sterile man who is not able to have a baby?
Thank you. علم ينسبوا جميع الانبياء الى انهم سهره.
And then Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam continues, didn't the people call the prophets as magicians? Didn't they accuse Lady Maryam, daughter of Imran, for being pregnant from a carpenter? And didn't the people call Prophet Muhammad a poet? As you can see, even the prophets of Allah and the saints of Allah were not safe from the slander and backbite of the people of their time. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I want to look at the topic of marriage. What is the position of the Quran and Islam on the sacred reunion of marriage and family relationships? The sad reality, brothers and sisters, is this, that when it comes to marriage, you know, there is no license you have to get. You know, when you go to, if you want to become a pharmacist, or you want to become an engineer, or you want to even do, let's say, you want to become a graphic designer or a professional photographer, or a whatever you want to do in life, you need to go to school. You go through elementary, junior high, high school, university. You go and educate, and you get a piece of paper from a university, a degree, that says now you are qualified to do a particular job. To drive a car. Our young boys and girls know that you need to take driving school, or you advise to do driving school. You will do in-class training. You'll write an exam. You'll have in-car training. And then you'll go and do your exam at the motor vehicles department. All of this just to be able to drive a car. But I would ask all of us tonight to think about this, that when was the last time that you heard that to get married, that you needed to take a course? In order for you to be allowed to have children, you needed to take a course on how to be a good mother or father. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen in our community. There are some Shia communities, I would say, that I have seen where the scholar who runs the community will tell his congregation that if you want to get married in my masjid and you want me to be there to officiate your marriage ceremony, you need to take a particular course in marriage that I offer in my center. But the sad reality is that most of our communities do not have that system. We're not equipped. We haven't created the manual. There are very few books in English and our other languages, I would say, that teach a man and a woman what they need to know going into marriage. And so we jump into it blindly, thinking that I watched enough television to know how to be a good wife. I've watched enough YouTube shows or Netflix to know how to be a good husband or father, or a good mother-in-law or a good father-in-law. But the sad reality is, brothers and sisters, that until we actually codify and ensure that these teachings of the Quran and Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam, unless we ensure that they are written and given to our next generation and taught to them, we're going to continue to face challenges, and they will only get larger and larger because of the system and the society that we are living in today. Not only in Canada, I'm sure if you look at the Muslim world, the Middle East, they are also, I'm sure, grappling with this same situation. So there's three questions I want to go through tonight, three points in this lecture for tonight. One is the institution of marriage. Where and when did this start? Number two is, what is the Quranic view on marriage? And what are the two prime governing factors that Allah has implemented or instructed for a man and a woman and a family to lead a successful Islamic life? And number three, if we have the time, is what to look for in a spouse and how to find that potential spouse within our lives. The first question is, how does this institution of marriage begin? Well, as I mentioned in the beginning, that when Allah created the first human being, Prophet Adam alayhi salam, he then created his mate. As Allah says in the Quran, even in Surah An-Nisa, where Allah says that he created the man and then he created the partner. Allah says right at the beginning of Surah An-Nisa that Allah says he created the spouse, and he created from that individual the spouse. Now, he doesn't say man from woman or woman from man or what the order was, but we know that Allah created Adam and he created Hawa alayhim assalam. The Quran doesn't tell us, so when we go to the hadith, we have a beautiful tradition that the late Shaykh As-Saduq, rahmatullah alayh, quotes both in his book, Man La Yahadhurul Faqih, in volume 3 in the bab, in the section of nikah, of marriage, and also in Ilul al-Shara'i. And basically, the summary of the story is that Allah created Adam, and he existed for a period of time, and then Allah put him to sleep, or he fell asleep. And in that time period where he was asleep, we're told that Hawa alayhi salam was created. Hawa is created. Adam wakes up from the sleep, and he sees this other person. He sees this individual whom obviously he didn't know who this was. He was just created, and a certain amount of time, however much it was or it wasn't, had elapsed. He sees another person, and he reaches out to touch her. And at this point, the angels intervene, and they say that, oh Adam, that this individual that you see, who has been created for you, to be to be in a relationship with you, you are not allowed to physically touch her until a process is carried out. And so Adam asks the angels, what is this process? And the angels go to mention that this is, what today you and I know as marriage. So Adam says, okay, well, you know, let's go ahead. Let's get this marriage over with. Let's get things done. And the angels say, well, you know what? There's a process. You have to ask her wali, her guardian, for permission. You have to present her with a mahar, a gift. And then you can enter into marriage with this individual. And so to make this long story short, he asked other questions to the angels. They responded. He asked Allah for the permission. Permission was granted. Obviously, Hawa alayha salam herself would have had to have give permission. The mahar, the gift which was required, according to the hadith that Sheikh As-Saduq quotes, are two things. One was that Adam would teach her the religion, and the salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. And then the marriage goes, and Adam and Eve, in some otherworldly realm, wherever they existed, they were married in the presence of Allah. And then obviously, as the Quran talks about, that they were in the garden, which was a garden of earth. They ate from a tree that they were required not to eat from, not that it was a sin. And they ended up coming down in terms of their status. They were living on earth, that the same earth that you and I live on. They had children, they had sons, they had a family. And obviously from that first union that happened, however many years ago it would have happened, we are here today. This is the first marriage that happened in the humanity, in the history of humanity. And obviously after that, every other marriage has taken place in a natural way between a man and a woman. A contract is agreed upon, a gift is given by the man to the woman, and they live. But keep in mind, brothers and sisters, just as those who are married got married at one point, and those who are in the future to get married, that this marriage that happened at the time of Adam and happens up until today is not just an agreement by a man and a woman to live together. No, we have to realize that as with every action in our lives, that a marriage is a contract between the man, the woman, and Allah. That the man will treat the woman as Allah wants him to treat her. That the woman will treat her husband in the way that Allah expects a woman to treat her husband. A marriage is not just like a business deal that you sign a contract. It is a contract, yes, in a way, but it is between three people: Allah, the man, and the woman. Because in Islam, as we know, that Islam governs all of the actions in our lives, and that when a man and a woman decide to marry one another, that they do so recognizing the fact that they will live according to the rules of Islam, that they will do their best to follow the sunnah of Rasulullah. How did the Prophet treat his wives? How did the wives of the Prophet treat Rasulullah? We don't have time to go into it, but if you have time, read how the Prophet and Khadija alayha salam, Umm al-Mu'mineen, the first and the most beloved wife of the Prophet, how she lived with the Prophet, how she helped the Prophet, how she respected the Prophet. And look at how the Prophet treated Khadija alayha salam. It was no less love than she showed him. The respect he showed her was as much, if not more, than what Khadija alayhi salam reciprocated with.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The role of the academic elite in making scientific discoveries. This is a part of the speech delivered on November 17, 2021, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with a number of the academic elite and top scientific talents of the country.
جوان نخبه ما باید دنبال این باشه خلاقیت در دانش و حالا فرض بفرمایید که مثلا نیروی جاذبه حالا مثال های قدیمیش ایناست دیگه از قدیم این مثال ها رو میزدیم نیروی جاذبه وجود داشت یکی اینو کشف کرد بر اساس او دانش هایی به وجود آمد
our outstanding youth must pursue this creativity in science. For example, there was gravity. These are common old examples that I have been using for a long time. Someone discovered this, and science was created based on it. There was the power of electricity in nature, but no one knew about it until someone discovered it. Based on this discovery, this vast field of science and technology was created. The same is true of new sciences such as nanotechnology, stem cells, and nuclear energy. The discovery of a truth in nature, of a tradition, a valuable law, or an element in the nature and science created by God can help you to realize a scientific point. Then that point will become science. Information will be compiled, improved upon, and led to technology and other such things.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
یه نکته دیگری که در باب نخبگان وجود داره، من قبلها هم یه وقتایی به این اشاره کردم، این است که یکی از هدف‌های جامعه علمی کشور، نه فقط نخبگان، همه جوامع علمی، البته در مورد نخبگان این بیشتر مورد نیاز هست، این است که باید به مسائل کشور فکر کنند، مسئله محور کار کنند.
Another point about the academic elite, which I have mentioned once before as well, is that one of the goals of the country's scientific community, not just the academic elite, but all the scientific community, should be to think about the issues troubling the country and work in a problem-orientated way.
Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.